Our sun is headed into solar maximum, the period of greatest activity in its solar cycle. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to the new podcast series called Space Weather Living History. During this series, you'll hear directly from the people who for years have been studying the evolution of space weather, how we make observations, and our capabilities to predict space weather events. Now, every 11 years on average, our sun reaches a peak period of activity called solar maximum. That's followed a few years later by a period of quiet called solar minimum. During solar maximum, there are many sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, all of which can affect communications and technology here on Earth. Now, the energy from those solar blasts can disrupt radio communications, upset electrical power systems, damage satellites and change their orbits, cause navigational equipment to make mistakes, and even endanger astronauts walking in space. The effects from these solar storms can be far-reaching. In fact, they can have impacts throughout our entire solar system. These conditions are what we refer to as space weather. Sound exciting? Let's get right to the next interview.
I'm Dr. Art Poland. I'm a solar physicist, and I used to work at Goddard, and now I'm a faculty member at George Mason University. And my primary research interest is the sun. And when I say it that generally, it's kind of exciting in that I've been able to do everything from building hardware to doing theoretical modeling. And so to cover all that, it's pretty difficult. But my primary research interest is really, how does the sun work? What is making storms on the sun? How does the energy get into the outer atmosphere, into the corona? It's just a physics problem, basically. And the way I attack it, now at least, is to analyze spectra to get the basic physics parameters. That's temperature, density, and velocity, and then the magnetic field strength of various places on the sun. We've gotten to the point in computers, which is very, very exciting, to where we can actually model all this stuff. When I was a graduate student back in the 60s, you could only dream of this. And now we're actually doing it, which is very exciting. And what that means is we need the observations to go into those models and to see, do we really understand what's going on or not? And in analyzing spectra, we need really good telescopes, spectrometers in space, and we're getting those things, which is, again, really exciting, something that you could only dream of 30 or 40 years ago. We're able to measure the temperature, the density, and the velocity of the material on the sun's surface, all the way from 5,000 degrees up to 20 million degrees. We're able to get all that information, and we're able to put it into models and see how good is our physics understanding. And that is indeed my interest, is what's going on? Do we really understand what's going on? And what's so exciting about it all now is we don't know. We can make the measurements, we can put it into the models, and in many, many cases, you don't get good agreement. You know, in some cases we do. When we do, we say, oh good, we do understand that. But there are other things that we're seeing that we can't match. And that's what makes science and what I do so exciting, is that we get some answers, and then we say, these answers don't match. We don't know what's going on. We got to figure it out. We have to see, how can we get the answer? What is going on in the sun? And that leads to new physics understanding. And that's what makes me so excited about what I'm doing. What's really funny, and again, this is the way science works. I mean, all the way from Galileo's time. When I started out, we had telescopes, we had spectrometers, so we could measure the temperature, we could measure the density, we could measure the velocity, but these telescopes had very low resolution. They were on the surface of the Earth, so that the Earth's atmosphere blurred them, and the technology we had was film. So we were actually taking pictures with a camera, basically, and you can't do that very fast. So your time resolution was pretty poor. So, and going through the Earth's atmosphere, you couldn't look in the ultraviolet and extreme ultraviolet. But we were doing the same kinds of things. We had computer models. They were really crude in that, you know, the biggest computer in those days wasn't what you have on your cell phone now. So the models were crude. The observations were crude. We were seeing things about the physics that's going on. But there was a lot that we didn't know. An exciting thing happened after World War II. They had these V-2 rockets, and some guys from NRL were approached and said, is there anything you could use these for? And they said, geez, yeah, we'd like to put a spectrometer up above the atmosphere and see what the sun looks like. They did that, and it was Dick Towsey who did it. And they got these spectra back, and the sun just looked amazing in these ultraviolet spectra. And all of a sudden, we had a whole new set of data information, more temperature information, more density information, more velocity information. That meant that we could do better modeling. And computers started getting better. And so it's better observations, better computers, better models. You found more things that didn't match. And this says, boy, I'd sure like to get better spatial resolution, a better time resolution. You build better spectrographs. And then on Skylab, we still had film on the spectrographs. So, okay, we could do better because we had better resolution. We had more data because those guys were up for like 9 months. And we were doing better modeling in those days. And Skylab was really exciting because that was the first time we got a really clear look at what's called coronal mass ejections. The big bubbles of gas and magnetic field that come flying off the sun. If they're aimed at the Earth, they come crashing into the Earth and interact with the Earth's magnetic field, space weather. That was the first really solid inkling we had that the sun was shooting these things off from prominences and big magnetic loops. We did know that flares were a problem. They even knew that during World War II. But they didn't really know about these coronal mass ejections. But on Skylab, again, we were limited to film, low time resolution, low spatial resolution. We started to say, okay, we got these things going. They're really interesting. And it was exciting for me. I was on the Skylab team that was working on them. You know, so some of the first papers on coronal mass ejections, I was a co-author on. But we started saying, geez, I wish we had better spatial resolution. I wish we had better time resolution. Again, the modeling started coming in. I got involved with somebody. We're doing a little bit of modeling, computer modeling of these things. How long do they last? How is the material flowing in them? Doing crude models like that. Then SolarMax came along in 1980. Again, a new coronagraph, better spatial resolution, and in that one we had electronics instead of film. It was basically TV camera kind of stuff. Better resolution in time, better resolution in space. Skylab was in 1973. Again, what's so exciting in science. Okay, Skylab, new data, new models, new things to look for. SolarMax, 1980, new data, better modeling, new things to look for. And for me at least, the next biggie was SOHO. And I was the project scientist on SOHO here at Goddard, the U.S. project scientist. It was a joint European-U.S. mission. We had fast detectors. Better resolution. We had spectrometers. We had a really good set of instruments to be able to measure, again, the basic physics parameters, temperature, density, and velocity. We still have not been able to measure magnetic field out in the outer atmosphere of the sun. That's a very difficult measurement to make. But with the new data from SOHO, and I guess what I have to say was the most exciting thing about SOHO is we had really good time resolution and good spatial resolution. So they had pretty movies. We were able to get these movies onto television. They were being shown on the 6 o'clock news, and all of a sudden, solar physics was exciting to the public because we had these exciting movies. It was great for us as scientists to be involved in something that the public cared about. Again, also was exciting because we were able to do better research on it. We started to get to the point after SOHO. I shouldn't say after SOHO because it's still running now in 2013. And SOHO was launched, by the way, in 96, so it's been going for a long time. All of a sudden, we had what I would have to start calling space weather. We didn't call it space weather at the time, but, you know, all of a sudden, we had a practical use We had these science instruments, and they were able to give a heads-up warning to power companies, to satellite operators, that, hey, there's a storm on the sun, and it's coming in 2 days, and it's liable to cause disruptions in the Earth's magnetosphere and the systems on the Earth. NOAA was picking this stuff up. They were actually taking live feeds from SOHO and putting it into their space forecast. I don't want to use space weather yet, because space weather wasn't really a term at the time. What then happened, and it was kind of interesting, I forget the exact year, but I decided, okay, I don't want to be project scientist on SOHO anymore. I don't want to be a manager anymore. I want to just do research. And so I quit my management positions, gathered all the stuff together, and started doing research again. And George Withrow came to me one day from headquarters, and he said, Art, we got this new idea. We'd like to start a program in space weather. What do you think? What George had to say said to me, this is exciting and we can really do it. We've got the tools, and if we can get the money to put together a space weather research program, this is going to be exciting. It can be like Earth weather. You know, we can put a bunch of space weather buoys out there in space and get really good predictions and do something useful for society. And so I dropped my research and said, okay, here I go again, back into management. And I worked with George and Dick Fisher and Bill Wagner and several other people to put together what would a space weather research program look like. What satellites do we need? What research do we know? You know, what kind of things we know? What do we need to know to be able to do something that's fun research for scientists and practical for society? It developed, and Bill Wagner was the one who came up with the living with a star idea. That's what we were going to call it, living with a star. And everybody said, great idea. We're going with, that's the title. That's what we're going to call space weather. We're going to call it living with a star.
In one of our recent interviews, we were laughing about the idea of how we could also have said living in a star, because we live within the atmosphere of the sun,
right,
which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so I went and started working down at NASA headquarters part of the time to help develop this program. And I was in the chief scientist's office, which was actually pretty exciting, because my idea or position there was to help put the sales package together to make this something that upper management and Congress would want to say, yeah, we should do that. And also to try to get the earth science people involved, to try to make it a really what the military calls a sun to mud approach, where something happens on the sun, we study it, we understand it, and it has an impact on the soldier on the ground. Actually, space weather does do that, because it affects communication, and it affects GPS, which affects how the those guided missiles that they send down somebody's front door, how well are they going to work? That is affected by space weather. So we became involved with the military. We became involved with NOAA. It became a multi-agency effort. FAA got involved, because it's in the long run, it was going to affect how airplanes land. I remember one day landing at Paris Charles de Gaulle Airport, and the fog was so thick you couldn't see the end of the wings, but yet they were landing this plane at the airport. And if the GPS wasn't working right, it wasn't going to work too good. And space weather is going to affect that. So here I was thinking, here, I'm working on this stuff that's going to impact what we're going to do. That's how I became involved in space weather. And one of the questions that's of interest to everybody is, what are the key events and turning points in space weather research? I'd have to say there were two big key turning points. The first one was SOHO, when we were able to get really cool movies and put them on the 6 o'clock news. All of a sudden, the public was aware of this stuff. And I'd have to give the NASA Public Affairs Office here at Goddard a lot of credit for that. They helped us put together movies that would sell to the news media. I mean, without that, we're not going to go anywhere. I remember as a scientist trying to get to the news people and say, hey, we got these really slick movies, and they wouldn't even call back. After the Public Affairs Office here started working with them and sending them movies, as project scientist, I was getting telephone calls from the news media. What do you got that's interesting? That was a big turning point, because all of a sudden we were of interest to the public. The next big turning point was George Withrow and the group at headquarters saying, we need a special new program within NASA that is space weather. And that is something that we can get major funding for. And we got like $1 billion over 10 years. And with something like that, you can put together a good set of satellites, you can put together a good research programs and make real progress. And what's exciting for me now is we did this all 10 years ago, 10 to 12 years ago. And I'm looking at it now and I'm saying it worked. We have a great set of satellites up. We're doing good research, really good research. And NOAA is actually taking our information and using it in a practical way for commercial space weather predictions.
I hope you enjoyed the Space Weather Living History podcast brought to you by NASA's Sun Earth Days program. You can learn more about the Space Weather Living History project on our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget to join our growing community of Facebook and Twitter fans for the latest information and facts about the new Sun Earth Day themes. For all other details about these programs, including information about our past Sun Earth Days themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov.
This is Troy Klein signing off.